Case number 08-3033 et al. United States of America v. Joseph Jones, also known as JoJo, appellant. Issue 1 and 2, Mr. LeCare-Lepar for the appellants, Mr. Strand for the appellees.
Good morning.
Morning. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Stephen LeCare, reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We have a lot of ground to cover this morning, and I would appreciate if the Court would indulge me, perhaps 4 sentences in which I'll summarize why we're here today.
Does that mean you don't want to be interrupted in the first 4 sentences?
That's all I'd ask for. Okay, and the rest of the time is fair grounds, fair play. After a six-month trial and 106 witnesses, the government's case against Daz Thurston failed completely, other than the fact he was convicted. He was convicted of selling 1.6 grams of crack cocaine. That's two of these little NutraSweet packs that I have in my pocket. In the normal scheme of things, he would have received 33 to 41 months as a sentence, significantly less than what he ultimately got based on a judge-found conspiracy. 900 times the amount of crack cocaine that he was found by the jury to have sold is what the judge determined. In the case of Antoine Ball, 150 times the 11 grams of crack cocaine that he distributed.
Are you 4 sentences up?
That's it.
All of the sentences were within the guidelines range, right? That's not the issue you have, correct?
Well, no, Your Honor. The sentences were within a dramatically enhanced guidelines range. They were not within
based on acquitted conduct. That's the key. But you take the acquitted conduct into account, and they were within the guidelines range. They were actually in the lower end of the guidelines range. Isn't that correct?
Well, ultimately, within the lower end of an artificial enhanced, that's correct.
Within the statutory maximum, right?
It's under the statutory maximum.
And isn't that the key?
No. I realize that a member of this panel observed that in the Settles case. And let me tell you why this is.
And just if I can interrupt, it's not just a member of this panel that has observed this. This is a consistent and well-established, perhaps wrong, but consistent and well-established legal doctrine that you are taking. You would be asking us to undo not only Settles and Brass and Dorsley, but taking on the Supreme Court on this one, right?
Actually, I'm not.
You're not. How so?
Okay. First of all, let me start with Thomas Paine. A long habit of not thinking of a wrong thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. This is not a Watts case. Watts was a double jeopardy case. Watts and Booker was distinguished and was very carefully distinguished in the Booker opinion. And it was court and Booker said we didn't have occasion to consider the Sixth Amendment implications or
rather than starting with Thomas Paine, why don't you start with Dorsley? How do we get around Dorsley? How do we get around Settles?
Because Dorsley came before the concept of reasonableness review was really established in Gall, Rita, Seven Union and Align. What Dorsley didn't recognize, Your Honor, and let me talk about the facts briefly in Dorsley. Dorsley was not a tail-wagging-the-dog case, anything of the dramatic type that we have here. What Dorsley talked about, it didn't recognize the as-applied doctrine because that hadn't even been developed at the time. That's something we urge the court to consider. The doctrine that Justices Scalia and Thomas articulated in Rita and Gall, that five judges in the en banc Sixth Circuit case, the United States versus Bonner, said, this is an idea whose time has come.
Counsel, what was Justice Scalia's remedy for the problem that he...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What was Justice Scalia's remedy for the problem that he perceived in his separate opinion in Rita?
Well, the problem that Justice Scalia...
I say he saw a clash between the Apprendi principle and substantive review. View substantive unreasonableness. What was his remedy for that clash?
Well, he suggested in part that it could be a procedural unreasonableness. But what I'm saying is,
but the bottom line of the opinion is that there should not be review for substantive unreasonableness.
But what he says also, the hypothetical that he uses in Rita falls perfectly within the facts of this case, where he talked about a situation where somebody's normal guideline range would have been 33 to 41 months, and he ended up with over 200 months based on facts that were not found by a jury. And what he said is, when you have a non-mind-run case such as that, we have a sentence whose reasonableness, whose ultimate reasonableness depends on non-elemental facts, facts of another offense, in this case a conspiracy, then you have a problem.
He assumes a level of clarity in appellate review of the substantive unreasonableness. It's probably missing. He says it's wrong to think of the legal ceiling for apprending purposes in terms of the particular branch of the system that creates it, and appellate courts can create such a ceiling. But that applies to the appellate courts, or imputes to the appellate courts, a kind of precision that the legislative bodies do attain, but I regret to say appellate courts very rarely do.
So this just happens to be one of those cases.
I mean, I think that the problem with his approach, even if you want to solve it by saying that substantive unreasonable should be preserved, but the sentencing firm acquitted conduct, say, should not, is that you're really talking about a system where you have two levels of the judiciary making what, in effect, are discretionary decisions.
You know,
we don't like to talk that way. We like to pretend that we speak with such extraordinary clarity. Hold one case and they just want to predict exactly what will happen in a later case, but it isn't so.
One of the problems you have with discretion is that the guidelines are not that discretionary. They are correct guidelines calculation is central to the application of
yes,
the system.
And that's part of procedural.
But the government takes the position that what we're asking to do is upend the whole discretionary system, whatever form of discretion you want to call it. Our position is that there's a fundamental injustice here where you have a tail wagging the dog situation. And let me talk about what Justice Scalia pointed out in Apprendi, where you have a doubling of a sentence. He said that's undoubtedly of constitutional significance. Now, I'm not asking you to overrule Dorsley, and I'm certainly not asking you to overrule
Dorsley was far more than doubling. It was quadrupling the sentence. Now, smaller sentences, to be sure, but that can't be the standard.
Well, this case is a quadrupling, and that, in our view, is constitutionally repugnant. And our position is that one doesn't have to overrule any of the prior circuit precedent. One can understand that circuit precedent didn't apply and it didn't govern a case that was so heavily dependent, as this case is, on judge-found conduct. 900 times the findings of fact.
Suppose the conspiracy hadn't been charged, but suppose the judge at sentencing with convictions for just the counts that have conviction said, I think there was also a conspiracy and I'm going to elevate the sentence for that reason.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, that's not our case. If you ask me to address that case, my position is it would apply in the same way. But he couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it, and then you really are saying that sentencing can't be as discretionary as it traditionally has been, or Booker has required it to be, I think.
Not at all. Not at all, Your Honor. If he had the offensive conviction, the range that would be, presumptive range that would be called for by the offensive conviction, if you look to a line, it would be fine, and our view is it would be fine to sentence within the presumptive range. The problem that you have here, and the problem you would have in your scenario,
but the guidelines are only advisory now, so I just think for constitutional purposes, and I have problems with this, but I think for constitutional purposes, you just look at the statute, the statutory maximum, and the judge, and that's usually going to be a huge range, and the judge has free rein to go within that range. That helps defendants in lots of cases, but it hurts them in some.
Well, we know it doesn't help the defendant in most cases, and it's absolutely clear you have problems with this. One can read that easily enough themselves.
And what I meant by that is the discretion granted by Booker helps defendants as compared to the guideline system that was mandatory beforehand. So that the Booker regime helps defendants in many cases, but this discretion does not help them in some, such as here. But there's just more discretion.
Except that I don't believe that the judge has discretion to violate the Constitution to make a finding that's so heavily dependent. defendant to make a judge-found finding of a non-elemental offense and to repudiate the jury verdict. I mean, we have empirical evidence in this case what happened. A foreperson wrote a letter of protest saying, what's going on here?
Well, so that in Settles, the defendant himself at the sentencing made a pretty eloquent statement about how unfair he thought it was, similar to the juror's statement here. And we noted that in the opinion.
And Judge Randolph did in Boney as well, saying, what's a gotcha game? But the problem is, when you have the jury here, we tried to stress in our brief, the jury is the people's voice in the judiciary. And what this does, what this practice does the following. Gives the government every opportunity to overcharge. Secondly, it invites disrespect, because the juror knows or finds out.
Judge Kavanaugh's question made clear, it doesn't require overcharging.
Your Honor, I'm having difficulty hearing you. I'm sorry.
The problem that you're identifying, I think all of us feel it is a serious problem, doesn't arise from the government overcharging. It follows from Congress's having provided such an extraordinary range of sentencing flexibility. And when you talk about range of sentencing, that you can't get below zero, that means a range on the high side. And you know, all of us see that, but it's a function not of the government charging, but of the very lofty ceilings on sentences that Congress has chosen.
And what I'm saying to you, Judge, if you read Cunningham, start with Cunningham, you realize there is a second level of constraints that operates within the statutory maximum. That second level of constraint is the presumptive guideline range for the offense of conviction. What you have here, and why I'm suggesting the as-applied doctrine is a theory that the court should evaluate. It's an open issue in this circuit. It says where you have conduct that is determinative, for lack of a better term, of what the sentence is, where you have conduct that is non-elemental, in this case a conspiracy, that wasn't found by a jury, that dramatically ratchets up an individual sentence, that has Sixth Amendment and also Fifth Amendment implications. That's our view of it. I realize Congress has devised this elaborate scheme, and that's what we live with, for better or for worse. But the problem with that scheme...
It's not so much the elaborateness of the scheme, it's the astonishing... astonishingly high level of penalties.
Well,
putting aside mandatory minimums.
Well, that's right. But again, Your Honor, I take you back to the line of cases starting with Cunningham, Rita Gall, going through Southern Union, and even a line, because what they basically stand for is this simple proposition: where you have jury findings of an offense that is a Sixth Amendment and also a Fifth Amendment violation, can be in certain circumstances, and this is the poster boy for those circumstances, where the ultimate sentence is driven by the findings of an offense that the defendant was acquitted of doing. I reserve my time, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Unless the court has further questions, which I'm happy. Perfect.
Thank you.
And thank you for four sentences.
I think Mr. Strand is next. Thank you.
May it please the court, Stratton Strand on behalf of the government.
How many sentences would you like before?
None, sir.
None, okay.
If I could just clear up a factual matter, the sentences that the judge imposed in this case were actually significantly below the guidelines ranges that, of course, were calculated on the basis of the acquitted conduct. The judge's questions suggest our position, which is that this circuit has definitively held that the only constraint in terms of Sixth and Fifth Amendment is this U.S. Code maximum. And accepting appellant's theory in this case would require a reversal of that binding precedent. There is no reason to believe that Justice Scalia's as-applied theory is inconsistent, let alone viable, inconsistent with our precedent, let alone viable. Judge Williams' question suggested, Judge Scalia lost his argument in Rita. Judge Scalia was suggesting a standard of reasonableness review that would not contain a substantive component, because he believed that any appellate review that involved judging a sentence for substantive reasonableness would introduce the constitutional infirmity that Booker sought to eliminate.
Well, in his original view, in Booker itself, obviously this would be unconstitutional if his view on the remedy had prevailed.
Right. And he then lost that argument.
Right, I know. I just thought I'd point out that this would be flatly unconstitutional under the views of the four justices in Booker who were part of the substantive majority, but the remedial dissent. Justices Scalia, Thomas,
right.
Stevens, and Souter, their views, this would be flatly unconstitutional. But they didn't prevail.
They did not prevail. And Gall was the case then that established definitively what the nature of substantive reasonableness review would be. And Gall made clear that that was a purely statutory exercise, which depended on judge-made findings for the assessment of substantive reasonableness. The trial judge is required to correctly calculate the guidelines range before imposing a sentence, and the appellate courts are to take into consideration the extent of any variance from the properly calculated guidelines range in determining the substantive reasonableness of the sentence. That construct for appellate review is flatly inconsistent with Judge Scalia's as-applied theory.
I'm sorry, it's flatly inconsistent with this what?
Because the standard of substantive reasonableness review depends upon judge-found facts. The trial court is
instructed. But that doesn't respond to his argument that a ceiling imposed by appellate courts is no different from a ceiling imposed by a legislature.
I believe that it precludes such an argument because the Supreme Court there is expressly endorsing appellate court consideration of judge-found facts within the statutory maximum.
Yes.
And if I may, I believe that Alene also is completely inconsistent with any as-applied theory. In Alene, Justice Thomas flatly stated that the exercise of judicial discretion in fact-finding within the statutory range, the U.S. Code's range, is not an element of Sixth Amendment jurisprudence. For Apprendi purposes, in Alene, Judge Thomas made clear, for Apprendi purposes, the legally prescribed range is the penalty affixed to the crime by the statute. And the court went out of its way to be clear what its ruling did not entail. Its ruling did not entail any incursion on the Booker rule that sentencing discretion within the statutory maximum is fully consistent with the Constitution. For all those reasons, we believe that the as-applied theory not only is inconsistent with this circuit's precedent, but also inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent. And, of course, the sentences that the judge imposed here are fully consistent with Settles and Dorsley and all of our other precedents. In fact, I would quickly point out that in Dorsley, as Judge Griffith's question suggested, that in Dorsley, the increase in guidelines range that was calculated based on the acquitted conduct was identical to that occurred here. It was
a four. The consequence is a little bit different in Dorsley. You're dealing with a much less prison time than we're dealing with here, right?
Correct. To the extent, however, that there's a suggestion that some sort of multiplier will be unconstitutional, Dorsley precludes that argument. And I would point out that there are, I know this court doesn't engage in vote counting by the Supreme Court where there's been no majority opinion, but it's simply not the case that the three justices in Cunningham supported the as-applied theory. In fact, Justice Alito, in his dissent with Justice Kennedy and Breyer joining him, stated, quote, "This court has held unequivocally that the post-Booker federal sentencing scheme satisfies the requirements of the Sixth Amendment." Obviously, none of those three judges was with Scalia, and Thomas also is not with Scalia anymore, obviously, in light of Alene. for all those reasons, we believe that the appellant's Sixth Amendment and Fifth Amendment claims are barred.
I guess that said, none of those cases specifically addressed the precise argument based on substantive unreasonableness. Is that true?
I think that's correct.
Theoretically, a bold court of appeals.
If I may, however, I believe even Judge Scalia has capitulated in the Alene dissent, which you're smiling at me. Are you anticipating my...
No, I just doubt he's capitulated. Yeah. But anyway.
Capitulation is not his style.
Perhaps giving up the ghost. The Alene dissent written by Roberts, in which Judge Scalia joined, stated that under 924C1A, the using or carrying a firearm statute that was at issue there, quote, the jury's verdict fully authorized the judge to impose a sentence of anywhere from 5 years to life in prison. No additional finding of fact was essential to any punishment within the range. Everyone agrees that in making the sentence determination within that range, the judge was free to consider any relevant facts about the offense and offender, including facts not found by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. That statement, too, is flatly inconsistent with an as-applied argument.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I'll try to follow up on your exchange, Judge, myself and government counsel, Judge Williams. What's reasonable about 18 years for less than 2 grams of crack cocaine? It's not conduct to be approved, but there's nothing that's reasonable about it.
Well, I mean, so, the difficulty with that is that Congress has done full up of that. Statutory ceiling here was perfectly okay.
I hope I can convince you that there's something that operates within the statutory ceiling called the guidelines. Otherwise, there'd be no need for a parsimony clause.
That you have to have not only the guidelines, but critical to your theory is that appellate judges are doing something very like what legislatures do, or even semi-legislatures like the Sentencing Commission. Setting ceilings. And I guess, speaking for myself, I thought that was the weakest part of Scalia's second opinion, Rita.
When you speak away from the microphone, yeah, Judge, yeah, it's hard okay. to hear you. And I have a hearing impairment.
It seems to me your argument depends on the proposition that what appellate courts do in substantive unreasonableness review is the equivalent of setting ceilings the way legislative bodies do. Scalia's answer to that is to say, well, nothing in Apprendi drew a distinction between which branch of government set the ceiling. But as a practical matter, there are lots of differences. The one that keeps striking me is the squishiness of the appellate review process for substantive unreasonableness. Once if this court comes out with a number, because we may come out with a number in the sense of saying 15 years for crime X for defendant Y was too much, but that is a common law judgment that has implications for future cases, but only rather vague ones.
May I respond to that a little
bit? Sure, of course.
I think our position on that is very simple. Whether you call it substantive unreasonableness, as applied review, or whatever, tail wagging the dog, whatever standard you look at it, you look at the Sentencing Commission statistic. We know from Pew that those are invaluable. You look to see what the average person gets. Nobody gets this kind of a sentence for this small amount of crack cocaine. Nobody. And the part that's even worse about it is they were so expressly sentenced heavily so, on the basis of conduct that a jury, after 6 months and 14 days of deliberation, repudiated.
That's, I meant to ask you your first appearance, whether you have any theory other than the brilliance of defense counsel as to why the jury rejected so much of the government's case.
Well, we stated in our brief, and some of that I think Mr. Martin will talk about, is that the government cooperators were just inherently unbelievable. And that's why I wasn't trial counsel below, but one can read the record and the cross-examination and understand why these people were rejected by the jury. But again, we're talking about judge-made findings of a conspiracy. And what do you do is denigrate the jury right. I thank the court.
Thank you very much.
Issue 5, Mr. Martin for the appellants, Mr. Strand for the appellee.
May it please the court, Anthony Martin on behalf of Joseph Jones. Your Honor, I was trial defense counsel for Joseph Jones. I don't come in this court very often. I don't know the more esoteric points. I don't know the players in the dissents in many of these different cases that you've talked about. And that's why we have Mr. LaCar here. But I can tell you something about what went on down at the trial level. And if you allow me briefly to tell you a little bit about the trial, I'd be happy to do that. Focusing on Mr. Jones, there were 92 counts in that indictment. Mr. Jones was charged with 6. That included a conspiracy, a RICO, an AWIC, and a Vicar, and there were 2 distribution counts. He was acquitted of all except for the 2 distribution counts, which totaled less than 2 grams, less than $35 in sale. As a result, his guidelines should have been somewhere in the order of 41 to 51 months. Now, even if the government argues that Joseph Jones was a career offender, which I'm sure they will argue, that still puts his guidelines at 57 to 71 months. But that's not what he received. Instead, notwithstanding the jury verdict, the judge found that Joseph Jones, Mr. Thurston, and Mr. Ball were all involved in a conspiracy, and what did he give Joseph Jones? 210 months. Now, the question was, why is it that the jury rejected the testimony of the witnesses? And I think that's a good question. If you look at page 1229 of the joint appendix, I think you begin to get an understanding as to why. Because 1229 is the page that starts the discussion of what I described as the rogues gallery in my sentencing memorandum. And what I did in that was I went through each and every one of these witnesses, the date and the time that they testified. Some of those witnesses, for example, included Cedric Connor. Cedric Connor was paid $187,000 in cash and kind for his testimony. And then there's no other way to put it. Gail Parsons, who also testified, was paid between $4,000 and $5,000 for her testimony, which included her phone bills. When the jury hears things like that, immediately they start to wonder, why is it that the government has to do this to get people to come forward and cooperate with them? And if so, how much weight should they give to those cooperators' testimony? And obviously they felt not very much. So that brings me back to the 2 that Joseph Jones was convicted of, the quids. Well, obviously they thought he did that, Mr. Martin. They must have believed that there was corroboration in that instance. There was. There were wires on the purchaser. And that is the only reason we believe that Joseph Jones was convicted on those 2 counts. So what did the judge do at the time of sentencing that we're arguing about here in the way of a procedural error? The guideline calculation, obviously, was driven by the quantity that he attributed to Joseph Jones because of the conspiracy, which was 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine instead of less than 2 grams. And that, of course, bumped Mr. Jones up to 360 to life, 30 years to life. So when you look at it from that perspective, you say, well, hey, 210 months isn't so bad. But tell that to the young man sitting back there, his son, that 210 months away from his daddy isn't bad. When I went through this case and I looked at it, I thought to myself, how could the Sixth Amendment guarantee the right to a jury trial and then a judge reduce a juror's determination to no more than window dressing? How can a judge say that I can consider acquitted conduct, notwithstanding the fact that a jury has determined that he's not guilty of the crime charged? And how could a judge sentence somebody for that? And it's hard for me to explain that.
How does the jury verdict really change things from what it would be if there were just a standard application of the related conduct notion?
How does the jury...
The jury... cannot convict unless it finds beyond a reasonable doubt. And it didn't, obviously, it didn't find beyond a reasonable doubt. But if the related conduct concept is acceptable, and it's really just a kind of, it's primarily just an extension of the sentencing preceded the guidelines.
Your Honor,
the jury verdict seems sort of irrelevant.
The jury verdict is irrelevant?
The acquittal is irrelevant in the sense that it means something that in the centuries of sentencing that have gone on is not enough to affect the what the judge can do within the statutory limit.
Well, let me talk about relevant conduct. You said, you mentioned something about relevant conduct. If the relevant conduct is supposedly the two sales, the government never linked those two sales to the conspiracy. Those two sales took place in August of 2000 and January of 2001. They were months apart. The packaging wasn't similar to anybody else's packaging. The quality of the drugs wasn't similar to the quality of drugs in anyone else's sale or distribution. There was no central source. So how could the judge say that that was relevant conduct, those two sales, and somehow therefore bootstrap into the conspiracy? And I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but it seems to me if those two sales are supposed to be the relevant conduct, then the government fails in relying on that.
You're essentially asking us to find clear error in the judge's finding of the facts, which we do, I guess, every so often, but once a character, famous blue moon.
Well, I can't ask you more forcefully than I am asking out of respect for the court, but yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking you to do. That's what I'm asking you to do. I've already talked a little bit about the Rose Gallery. I didn't talk about the other problems with the proceedings.
And the trial court recognized that it was a rogues gallery, to use your phrase, right? I mean, he recognized that there were significant problems with the credibility of these witnesses, right? I mean, he did not ignore that.
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. I looked at the sentencing transcript again just yesterday, and it seems to me that he glossed over that. I didn't see any detailed discussion on why, notwithstanding the fact that somebody had received money or notwithstanding the fact that they had received a substantial reduction in expenditure.
I thought that he took that into account and said that, nevertheless, there's mutually corroborative testimony amongst these rogues, right? He realized he wasn't dealing with the choir. He was dealing with some pretty unsavory characters,
and yet that's true.
And yet he made a credibility determination that was perhaps different than the jury's. Is he allowed to do that?
I think all judges, to some extent, all trial judges have to make a credibility determination. I think
make credibility determinations as a court of review, what's our obligation with respect to credibility determination made by the
I think
the
you're supposed to give deference to the trial.
It's extreme deference. I mean, it's very rare that we second guess that.
And what is the deference that's supposed to be accorded to a jury? I think that their deference, that's the problem here. The judge is doing something that the jury has rejected, and I go back to the Sixth Amendment. They've been denied. These gentlemen have been denied their right to determination by a jury. The last point that I wanted to make was with respect to the judges granting the instruction for multiple conspiracies. In his own mind, as he watched what was going on, obviously he thought, and I'm talking about during the course of the trial, which, by the way, started really with the voir dire in February and ended with the verdict in December. So the trial was a little bit more than 6 months. Anyway, he gave this multiple conspiracy instruction, so obviously he saw that there were individuals and there were cliques that were not necessarily aligned with this overall or umbrella conspiracy. And I think that that's an important consideration in determining whether or not his analysis during the sentencing was properly conducted, because he never addressed the fact that Mr. Jones or the others, that is Thurston and Ball, were involved in a joint entity or operation and at the same time could have been involved in something separate. He never talked about that at all. And in short, even if you find that he was that is the judge below at sentencing, even if you find that the sentencing proceeding was not procedurally flawed, we would still say that the sentencings are substantively unreasonable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, a quick factual point. Jones's guidelines range, without consideration of the acquitted conduct, as a career offender would have been 262 to 327 months. Ball's guideline range, without consideration of the acquitted conduct, would have been 151 to 188 months, given the 1.5 kilograms of crack that the judge found he personally distributed. The primary procedural claim that is being advanced here is that the trial court simply failed to make a credibility determination with respect to the testimony of the cooperators. And that suggestion is refuted by the record. The court specified the details, quote, details of the testimony that it credited. It made clear, it explicitly said that it found those details to be reliable testimony, not only having observed the trial itself for the 9 months, but also in light of the mutual corroboration among many, many witnesses, and in light of the 11 guilty pleas and proffers, Newitt Ford's conviction of the same conspiracy. It found the test, it made absolutely apparent on the record that it was in fact crediting specific testimony, and it gave the reasons that it credited that testimony. Appellants did not object below to the court's explanation of its reasons for finding these specific aspects of testimony credible. So, of course, review here would be for plain error. There was no error, let alone plain error. Your Honor, the question that was posed about clear error is absolutely correct, we believe. Here, in order to reverse the judge's factual determinations, the court would have to find that the court's account of the evidence was simply not a plausible one in light of the record as a whole, and that's not a determination that can be made in light of the host of evidence that is detailed in our brief. I'd like to respond to the general notion that the jury's verdict was disrespected here. In fact, the judge did take into account the acquittals.
I don't know you're going to get very far on this, and nor do I think it's essential to your legal claim. But the whole problem I have with this is exactly that the jury's verdict is disrespected, and that was made clear by the dissenters in the Booker remedial opinion. So I don't know that you want to tell me that actually it hasn't been. It has been in some respects, but the way the law works, the statutory maximum is what is most important. But the jury's verdict, I think if I were a juror, I think like the juror here, I would not feel good about what happened.
I agree with Your Honor that it's not at all.
A juror would wonder, what was I doing sitting there on the conspiracy counts, sitting there for months on end, and then to carefully weigh the evidence and to come back. And I understand the difference, obviously, in the burden of proof. I get that. But still, I think a juror would feel not great about that, as one didn't.
If I could make three responses. Mm-hmm. One is, I agree with Your Honor that the atmospherics that I was about to present are not essential to our legal argument.
Right.
Number two, the point I was trying to emphasize was simply that the trial court, the sentencing court here, did mention the gross disparity between what the guidelines range would have been for the crimes of conviction and what the guidelines range was, taking into account the acquitted conduct, and discounted significantly the sentences from the guidelines range, in large part on the basis of that quote-unquote gross disparity. And the extent, and going 144 months below for Jones, going 68 months below for Thurston and 67 months below for Ball. The extent to which the court, in fact, considered that gross disparity, I think, is apparent from the sentence that Newitt Ford got when he was convicted of that conspiracy. He got 240 months. He was a much smaller player than any of these defendants. So that was the point I was trying to make there. Mm-hmm. And in terms of how the jurors would feel, the Sixth Circuit en banc has addressed that, I think, quite eloquently. The jury and the judge, obviously, as Your Honor knows, play different roles. The jury does, in fact, define the outer limits of the available sentence, and with the judge is permitted on a lower standard of proof to consider facts on a lower that in setting the range within that statutory
limit. But that sort of argument at an abstract level may be persuasive, but doesn't that fall apart when you have, as you've used the phrase, gross disparity here? We have a gross disparity between the sentence that the jury may have had in mind and what we ended up with, right? We're talking about vastly different schemes.
Well, that's the scheme that this circuit has approved, and that has long been since the framers.
But the way you just framed it rhetorically was that the jury set the outer limits here, right? Well, that's not what happened in this case, right?
As a matter of law, the crimes of conviction set the outer limits. Mm-hmm. That was the only point I was making. Okay. As to the suggestion that the trial judge did not ever make a finding as to single conspiracy, I think the record as we've cited it makes absolutely apparent that the judge found that all three of these appellants had engaged in a single conspiracy with their named co-defendants to distribute crack in Congress Park for the charged period. And as to the substantive reasonableness, of course, this court presumes that sentences within a properly calculated guidelines range are reasonable, and this court has never found that a sentence below the properly calculated guidelines range is unreasonable. And for that reason, obviously, these sentences, which were properly calculated, cannot be deemed substantively unreasonable. If there are no further questions, I'll sit down again.
Your Honor, real quick, I don't intend to chase my tail. The counsel for the government said something about a discounted range in this sentencing. There's no discount when your constitutional rights are being violated. He also talked about this being a single conspiracy. It's well settled that mere presence or association doesn't make out a conspiracy. These guys knew each other from middle school. They grew up in the same neighborhood. They're there in the neighborhood. And in many instances, there were competitors in an open-air drug market. And his final point, I think, was about the presumed reasonableness. That's right. It's presumed. It's not irrebuttable. Thank you.
Issue 6, Mr. Zucker for appellants, Mr. Strand for appellee.
Please, the Court. Jonathan Zucker and Patricia Doss on behalf of appellant Thurston and co-appellants. The issue I'm addressing is much less complex than the issues addressed by prior counsel. It's really just the speedy sentencing issue. Speedy sentencing has been adopted or assumed by Pollard and then by Yelverton and Gibson in this case, in this circuit. It's basically analogous, and what is applicable are the four Barker v. Wingo standards, length of delay, reason for delay, defendant's assertion of the right to go forward.
Is Jones claiming a speedy?
I think Jones's position is somewhat different because Jones was sentenced within a reasonable time mark. However, as a result of the
he didn't raise that before the district court. The others did, correct?
I don't think he could have. I think he joins in this issue because due to the consolidation, his right to appeal, his speedy right to appeal, would have been similarly affected. And so he suffered that same prejudice as did the co-appellant, though it could not be framed as a right to speedy sentencing. But nonetheless,
what exactly is the prejudice? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure,
go ahead.
Okay. Well, and I think we're going to get to where you're going in a minute, but the government has conceded and the court conceded that two of those elements were readily met. The length of delay was unreasonable in this case, and the defendants, both Bull and Thurston, asserted their rights steadfastly. Matter of fact, the government not only didn't oppose it, they actually joined or consented to numerous sentencing requests. So what we're left then with is the reason for delay and the prejudice. Now, the reason for delay given by the court at the time of sentencing was that a co-appellant had filed a Brady motion, and that was David Wilson, in relation to Brady material related to a 1997-1998 series of murders, which had absolutely nothing to do with any of the appellants in the courtroom today. It was completely irrelevant for a determination of sentencing on Thurston and Ball. Whatever Brady had been suppressed in relation to some murders that preceded their drug distribution counts, it was of no consequence. It was completely irrelevant. And so the reason for the delay is simply neglect. It was just delayed because the court didn't want to set or chose not to set a sentencing date. But the reason for delay that was proffered was should not be credited and should not be given any deference.
It was clear in advance of the disposition of the Brady proceeding that could have no effect?
I believe so, yes, because the Brady, and I can't even specifically recall what it was, but it had to do with witnesses to the murder. And it was a 1997 murder that was the basis or the impetus for a 1998 murder of two people. And whatever occurred didn't matter in terms of Ball and Thurston, in terms of drug sales that came about 3, 5, 7 years later. So it was completely inconsequential. I mean, had everything Wilson asserted in his Brady motion been found and granted, there would have been no basis for which Thurston nor Ball could have sought relief. Matter of fact, neither of them even joined in the Brady motion because it had no bearing on their drug distributions that they were convicted of. So, yes. So the reason for delay was completely not connected, irrelevant, and shouldn't be credited. The prejudice is a hard one to assess, but I think if one starts from the presumption that you have a right to a speedy trial and you have a right to speedy sentencing, then the delay in and of itself is prejudicial. Can we point to specific facts where the defendants were prejudiced?
Well, at trial, you can see how witnesses' memories, witnesses disappear, all the things you're well familiar with. But at sentencing, it's a little more challenging to see the prejudice.
Actually, if you want to see it or you want to look for it in this case, it's there because there were three witnesses that would have been available: defendant's mother, defendant's the mother of his children, and the third relative, who I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's mentioned in the sentencing memorandums, that died. Mm-hmm. They were unavailable as a result of this delay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was that specific type of evidentiary prejudice. Right. Would they have made a difference in the sentencing? You know, who knows? Who knows? I mean, they would have testified primarily to mitigating factors that really probably would not have affected the assessment of whether or not there was a conspiracy, which was the driving aspect of the sentencing.
They weren't witnesses for the factual component of the sentencing.
Certainly not as to the conspiracy, no. Yeah. But nonetheless, Would those fact witnesses have provided mitigating evidence that could have affected sentence and was defendant prejudiced by not being able to produce that? Yes. But I think even independent of that, before you get to the specifics of what you were denied presenting because of the delay, there is just the fact of the delay in and of itself is prejudicial. For a defendant to remain in limbo.
I understand your analysis, but it's effectively removing the prejudice component.
I didn't understand your question. Your comment.
I understand your theory and the principle, and it has some merit, but it effectively deletes prejudice as a requirement. I would say it's automatic.
I would say it's, if you have a right and you're denied that right, then you are prejudiced from the denial, and that you need not necessarily point to specific instances. I mean, you could point to, are you prejudiced from the fact that you have to sit in D.C. jail in limbo for 3 years in this case on behalf of well, Thurston and Bull, but one was 35 months, one was 40 months, rather than going on with your life, going on to a federal penitentiary.
Life in a federal penitentiary.
Well, there's a qualitative difference between the two, Judge, I would beg to say. There's a qualitative difference between sitting in the D.C. jail as a holding facility and nothing more. At least when you get to the feds, the federal system, there are programs, there's a different quality of life involved. That is a prejudicial aspect. But it's also just the prejudice of living in limbo, waiting, you know, knowing you have this right, and this right is being frustrated simply by a judge's neglect.
What remedy, then?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think that's somewhat intertwined with what you do in relation to the issues that Mr. LaCar raised. There was, I guess, given the context of this case, the remedy we would seek, because it's intertwined with the whatever you do with the sentencing generally, given the length of delay, I would ask that the defendants be released on bond pending a remand of their sentencing, because there was such a substantial issue on the sentencing in this case that the idea that they could go back on a remand and there would be that much more delay, and the sentences that have been served are so far above what, if the court credited and said, you know, something closer to a guideline sentence is what is warranted here, that we're so far above that, that the what would make sense in this context would say bond pending resentencing. The alternative remedy we proposed was to give credit a reduction of sentence proportionate, i.e. for every day that was sentencing should have gone forward and then it was delayed, take one day off the sentence that was imposed. I guess those are the two remedies I would suggest off the top of my head. But again, they are going to be intertwined with what you ultimately decide on the what I'll say is the larger issue in this
case.
Well,
the second remedies would be independent of that.
Yes, I would say that's true, and that certainly would be, it would be ameliorative. All right.
Other questions? I think you passed your time. We'll give you a couple minutes back on that rebuttal.
If there's no other questions, I don't know.
Jones, of course, has no sentencing delay claim because his sentence was not delayed. He was sentenced on May 5th, 2008, and he never requested that his appeal here be deconsolidated from Balls and Thurston's.
Do you disagree that there was a speedy sentencing violation here?
I do, because, as Judge Williams's question suggests, part of the speedy sentencing analysis is whether the defendant has been able to demonstrate, quote, meaningful prejudice. And the defendant's appellate.
Let's start here. Was there any justification for taking so long to sentence? You're not going to defend that, are you? You're going to defend it on the prejudice prong, right?
We're defending it primarily on the prejudice prong because the judge himself acknowledged that the delays had been too long to a certain extent. I don't think it's fair to simply discredit the reason that the judge gave for part of the delay. I think that was a legitimate reason, and we shouldn't presume that the district court was lying. The Brady claim was, in fact, reasonably related to these sentences because the Brady claim involved Bobby Cappies and Killebrew, who were two of the primary cooperators whose testimony went to the conspiracy claims. But, again, our primary...
So your argument is that although it's true that the particular testimony of theirs that was challenged in the Brady proceeding related to things too remote, the general principle that an apple can be, the rottenness of an apple in one part may mean it should be taken as completely rotten.
I think that was his reasoning. Yeah. But again, this claim comes down to an inability to show prejudice. Appellants have. They claim that some witnesses were unavailable, but they have not even proffered what the testimony of those witnesses would have been. They have acknowledged just now that there would have been no effect on the length of the sentences imposed, and they haven't explained why the remedy, the prophylactic remedy that Judge Roberts himself provided, 12 and 15 months reductions in sentence for the portion of the delay that he considered to be unreasonable, have not suggested why those remedies would be inadequate in light of Yelverton, which approved a much lesser remedy as sufficient to remedy any possible prejudice. So for those reasons, the sentencing delay claims must fail. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgments of the district court.
Mr. Strand, we'll give you 2 minutes. I'm sorry. Mr. Zucker, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Rule 32.
The district court said he was reducing the sentences already. Why isn't that the sufficient remedy here?
I would say in the context of this case, it isn't. Given a 3-year delay, a 12-month reduction isn't sufficient. And I also think we have to bear in mind.
Well, if he disagreed with you on the Sixth Amendment analysis, why isn't his remedy sufficient?
I mean, I don't want to repeat the same argument, but given the length of delay, a 12-month reduction would not be sufficient. But more importantly, in the context of this case where the judge, there was the most convoluted interpretation of an application of sentencing guidelines. I mean, the sentencing guidelines, actually, I believe for Mr. Thurston, should have been 27 to 33. There was a dispute as to whether. The initial guidelines.
Always convoluted. Aren't guidelines calculations always convoluted?
More so in this case, because there was a backdrop of a change in the law that went into effect 2 or 3 days after the sentencing, and we were arguing that that should have been what applied, and that would have taken, just given the counsel conviction, it would have taken Mr. Thurston down to a 27 to 33-month range because the criminal history would have been 3 instead of 4. The court got up and said, given the factors of the conspiracy, I believe a 14-year sentence would be appropriate, and then the court imposed a 16-plus-year sentence, saying the court was constrained by the guideline calculations, which were based upon applying guidelines to offenses that the defendant was never convicted of. So given all of that, I respectfully suggest, and though I do acknowledge that Judge Roberts, in compliance with Yelverton, tried to impose some kind of remedy for what he acknowledged was an unreasonable delay, I would suggest that in the context of this case, it was too little too late.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me point out that counsel for appellants were appointed by the court, and we thank you very much for your assistance. Case submitted.